Hello and welcome to Through the Mist with me, your host Owen. This is a Void Inverse Theory podcast where we look at the law and try to understand how it all works. In this episode, we'll be looking at gods! Oh my gods. Look at her butt. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome, hello, say hi. Come in, take a seat. It's just me again. We had a run of guests, but no, this is it. The run is over. The guests are done. For how long? Who knows? But it's just me again. Your darling Owen is here within your ears, making sweet, sweet noises. Yeah, welcome back. How's everyone been? We've had a busy month, haven't we? Hey, busy. Busy old month. Things have happened. Let's get into the most important one, which is I'm recording this day after Chalice Day. So Chalice came out yesterday. And have I already finished the book? Yes. I started it at about 10 o'clock p.m. and I finished it about 2 a.m. Yeah. So that was my night last night. Book. Oh, so good. Loved it. Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to spoil things. Spoilers. No, not here. Not today. Maybe next month. But the book is just, yes. I don't have anything outright to interpolate for theories. So I don't even know if we're going to do a book theory like we have for the last the two that have come out since I've been doing this podcast. Yeah, I don't really know. So we'll see how that works. I'll decide next month. But that's future Owen's problems. Let's talk about past Owen. And the last episode where we had Charlie on and we talked about satyrs and nymphs, I asked the question out on to the world, are satyrs a type of nymph? And we got some responses, as per usual, for some lovely people. I say as per usual, I always have this massive fear that absolutely no one's going to respond. So please never play that practical joke on me. I've now had fairly consistent responses and it's making my life so much happier. That it's a nice way to know that people care. So we've had some responses, yay. We had two in total. I bet you can't guess who one of them is. Now, say it with me, everybody. Davian, that's right. Round of applause. You're not getting another round of applause, actually, Davian. No, I've given you a big cheer once. No, that's it. Never again. Davian has come in. And also, we've had some a response from Magical Myth, who responded to the question, no. Just stated straight, no. Satyrs are not a type of nymph. And we also had Darian, which agreed with the sentiment, but also gave more of an explanation. And I shall quote that to you now. I don't think so. I think nymphs and satyrs are the same species in the Voidenverse, but I don't think satyrs become nymphs through death. Not every plant life has a nymph. Also, satyrs could very well end up in the underworld when they die, and I believe otherwise because a plant appears in the place of their corpse. We get this satyr's death fact from Grover, who also claimed that mortals go to the Greek underworld and still see what the mist shows them. He is an unreliable source of death. And yeah, when Davy is on, we talked about that when in the death episode about how Grover is a very unreliable source of death. And the fact that Rick just retcons things left, right and centre. So whatever stated in the newest book is the truth, and the oldest book has to be taken as basically the character not actually knowing how it all works. And like us, who we know exactly how everything works, don't we, guys? We know everything.
If anyone doesn't know, get sarcasm. I don't know what shift is here. I accidentally squeezed my nose, so we're making this noise now.
Yes, so I do think that the whole Satan nymph thing is complicated, and I have started to lean on the side of they're not the same species, or like a type of nymph, but at the same time, my brain goes, well, what are they? How does this work if they're not? I guess the answer's magic. So, yay! But yeah, I never felt quite safe saying Satan's a nymph. It doesn't sit right. in the belly, but I can't make anything else work or sit right in the belly. So I'm just, it's a soup, and the soup is souping, you know? You get me, boys? There's one thing I wanted to cover. One more thing. New book, past episode. But there's one more thing I want to cover before we go any further. And that is seaweed beans. Seaweed brains, a Percy Jackson podcast. Interview with Mark Oshiro. Yeah, they got Marky Mark on. They did it. They talked to them. And it was great. I learned things. And also, we're right, lads. We're right. We are correctamundo. Boom, shakalaka. Our madness is maddening. And everyone's there with me. It's, yeah, boy. What if the boy? Yeah. Because there was talk about canon and lore and how, like, what useful. Like, it was nice. Affirming thing to hear that Rick is aware of the canon and the lore of his universe and doesn't just go screw it, but at the same time, every new book that is written, the lore can be manipulated and deepened, and it is like a swirling soup, as I've written here in my notes. How the base theory that we've now settled on, or at least in this podcast, when I say we, I mean I, and since I'm the one talking here, you're all included. I am Owen, I speak for the mist. I love this, like, how the baseline idea is, like, that we've come up with is the baseline idea, basically, of how Rick approaches the book, and how the Roiniverse works with all the perception things, and how you perceive something changes how it functions, and what it reflects back onto you. So as Rick has changed over time, and how the world has changed over time, so has the universe and the lore changed with it. So as perceptions change, so does the lore in the Roidenverse. And it works. It doesn't break the book, because that's how the books work, which I love. Like, Rick can change. He can make the books better. He can do stuff. He can bring in Mark and they can help Rick with this change, and they can feed into the universe without breaking the universe, because their perception matters and affects how the universe runs on a base level, on like a baseline lore level, which is really cool to think about when I think about how much Rick has at least tried to be inclusive and make sure everyone has some form of voice, maybe by accident, maybe on purpose, who cares? Really, but like, and then when brings Mark in and they add their voice, and their voice matters to the lore of the universe, to the how the function of the world, and how that is also true in the world where your idea matters and affects how everything kind of works together. I'm now thinking of a line in the new book that we're going to ignore for now. Partly because it's a spoiler, and partly because reasons. I shouldn't have said that. Go read the new book. Go read Chalice, people. Go do it. It's up there in my favourite Percy Jackson books now. 100% up there. And for reasons that I've never liked a book before, which is very important to me. Yeah. Right, I think that is that. Okay, let's get to the reason why you all clicked on here and talk about the gods. And when I say the gods, I mean all of them. Every god that could possibly exist in the Roidenverse and does exist in the Roidenverse. Rick knows how to go hard. But because we only really know about three to four, depends on how you want to look at the world, different pantheons and groups, and so we're gonna just look at those three in detail and see if we can come to grips with gods and what is a god, what makes all these deities linked, why Why are they all gods? Is there some kind of link between all of this? And can we come up with this, like, scientific reason as to how and why? Like, can we come up with, using an approximation of the scientific method, can we reason our way to saying, yes, this is a god. This is what makes a god a god. Because I've been alluding to a couple of times this big idea I was having and coming towards. And I started doing this, writing the notes up for that episode, and I realised I'm nowhere near ready yet. My thoughts aren't collected in my head, I haven't actually worked all the details out yet, and I need to. So, we're going to look at we're going to struggle through one of the other issues that is in my head with this, and then maybe move on for a bit. Do some other fun stuff, don't make this link, look at some other wild and zany things. And then maybe we'll come back to this later and see if we can, using that knowledge and maybe just flicking through other stuff, will help come up. And then maybe in the background, I'll keep on working on this idea until I can get something that is presentable to you guys and we can work through it. But right now, we're going to try and tackle the gods and what makes a god a god. So we're just going to get the basics out of the way and then we'll go into some talk. Who we're talking about? We're talking about the Greco-Romans, we're talking about the Egyptians, we're talking about the Norse. They're the gods we're going to look at. The easy surface layer stuff to know is the Greco-Roman and Norse gods had a fundamentally different way of inhabiting the world than the Egyptians. The Egyptians' gods have no physical form, where the Greeks and the Norse do. And another thing that is baseline, at least for us and our understanding of how we've presented it so far, is that what a god represents can change on what people believe. And I say, we have said this is true for all gods. We know this is 100% true for Greco-Roman gods. We've got Apollo confirming this. But we're going to look through this deeper and try and see if that is true. So they're the two main things to know before moving forward. So let's do that. Let's move forward. So, we'll just run through the gods, different pantheons, pick out some key points about how they run, how they work, how the godliness is. So, let's start with the one we have the biggest knowledge base on, the Greco-Roman. I say the biggest knowledge base because now it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 full books on them. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4 companion books on them. Well, 4.5 companion books on them. That's a lot of my shelf space is taken up by this world. I love it. I think it's great. It really shows me. So let's start with them, because we do really have the most information on these guys. And that, big things to know, their physical form is actually influenced by their center of power. They get a Americanized version of themselves. Interestingly enough, their center of power moves. And actually, not just their center of power, almost everything else associated with that center of power moves with them. The manifestations of these ideas move with their center of power. We're not going to get into what the center of power is or what it means. Not today, maybe another time. I'll add it to the list. Actually, I will add it to the list. Anyway, back on track. So everything moves. Another key point is they bleed. Inca. So the golden blood of the gods. Couple other key bits of information. They don't die. They fade. So they disappear from existence. And that they have two major forms, Greek and Roman. Hence why I refer to this pantheon as the Greco-Roman. Yeah, center of power moves, everything moves, they bleed Inca, they fade, and they have two major forms. If we go to the Egyptians, who, considering they have three main books and one and a half companion books on them, they really are, which compares to Magnus Chase and the Norse by 0.5 of a companion book, they really do have more, like, just fleshed out information about them. They're a bit more easier to gauge and understand. And so the Egyptian gods are much more like what traditional spirits. They possess physical forms to survive in the world, mortal world. They can be there for a bit, but if they want to stick around, they have to become one with a physical being. They don't have their own physical forms that they can interact with the world with. They live in the Daunt. They have no true center of power. I think this is talked about in the books as they did have a center of power of Egypt, but as the world expanded and etc., enough of the world was influenced by the Egyptian architecture and stylings, and it wasn't necessarily ripped and like used as a blueprint, which I guess you could say more for the Greco-Roman. They kind of are everywhere now. So they don't need a centre of power, and they don't move with the centre of power because they don't live adjacent to the as part of the physical world. They live separate to it. They live beneath it. They also don't really die. They just get lost in the Daunt. Then we end up on the Norse, who really ruin it. So they have physical forms. They live in a parallel world or worlds. So this is, you know, a little confusing. We might consider Boston being their center of power, but it's not their center of power. It's the center of the cosmic universe, which makes an easy travel point, which makes it their entry and exit to other worlds. Like, we truly know the least about how this godly pantheon works as a godly pantheon. And that might to do with history, but another key point to know is that they can die. We know this because of the whole Ragnarok thing, and we've also got Balder, who literally dies in the stories, and we do meet him in Nine of the Nine, don't we? Nine from the Nine? I think we meet him in Nine from the Nine. I also found out about these apples when doing some research from the goddess Idun, and it kept the gods eternally youthful. They nom 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 nom, and then they stay young. If they don't nom 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 noms, they get old. It's unclear if they just get look old and lose their ability to look young, and but their lives are still long lived, or if they don't eat the nom 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 noms, they would die. We also have some other key figures from the Norse mythology, such as Odin's father, who have died? Question mark. I don't know enough about Norse mythology, and I didn't research this particular fact, but they have definitely seemed to have disappeared off the face of the world. Like, they don't exist. So that's another thing for they can die camp, you know? It's another piece of evidence for the they can die camp. Yeah, so that's the sets of gods, but what links them together? Do they mix? Drum roll, please. The answer to do they mix? This is a terrible drum roll. We'll do it again. Ready? No, terrible. It was not consistent beats. Okay, one more go. Hang on, I've got to ask the question first. Do they mix? We'll find out. I've got to keep this, you know, entertaining. That's what the core is, the entertaining. I can't just, like, give you yes, no answers. What's the point in that, you know? I started the drum roll and I wanted to not stop it. So the Greco-Roman Egyptians are surprisingly good at coming. They coincide with each other rather well. Both have groups of very strong spiritual connections to, like, the whole brain and, like, universe and, like, influencing thing. They fade and getting lost have this, like, weird crossover. And, like, why both things happen is also good. We also know of gods that are created from both pantheons mixing together. Mr. Be Quiet. The only true difference is how they interact with the world. Like, on a base level, Greek and Greco-Romans have a physical interaction, whereas the Egyptians have a more spiritual interaction. That's like the base difference between the two, really. You can see a lot of crossover, and I feel like you can make that crossover work rather well. The Norse's, on the other hand, they don't seem to fit well in this Venn diagram that I've created. Maybe you could argue magic, and like they have magic children with mortals, which fits them into the Greek crossover point, but they don't then fit into the Egyptian crossover point, because that's the thing Egyptians can't do, because they don't have a physical form. We also get the other guys in Norse mythology that like minor as guardians in like ways, like you get Surtr and you get the ice giants, some of the ice giants like Utgard Loki and people like that, who are on par, like power level and like life and everything like that, are on par with the gods, the Asgardians, but we wouldn't class them as such. And like, this is not, again, we're not even considering that every single story we've ever told and a large group of people have believed in is also true. So what links the ideas of all these gods together? And truly, the only real link between like these three groups, which is actually a really good set of groups to pick, because we got two that go, oh, I can see how they're the same thing, and one that goes, well, this is confusing. And it's why we class them as gods. It's why we would consider, same reason why we consider the Olympians gods, but Juniper not. Why we have now switched how we use the word nymph from minor goddess to what it is today, nature related. And that's because a god is a representation of the manifestation of some part of existence
or post-existence.
Like, they are ways in which we understand why the world works the way the world works. They aren't river. They aren't tree. They are earthquakes. They are the sun. They are day and night. They are these big idea thoughts, not the small idea thoughts. And that's really the only thing that links these groups together, is that the Norse gods still represent these ideas in some way, shape or form. It's a little harder, and partly that's because of the whole where we get Norse mythology from and how they didn't really, like the originators of these stories didn't, not even the originators, when they were being told, they weren't being written down by the people telling them. Yeah, is closer to what happens with Greco-Roman and like with Egyptian stuff. We've kind of backdated it as such by reading the stories that the hieroglyphs tell us. As part of it, I believe that's how this all works. But Norse is different in that way. But the same principles and our understanding of them apply. Thor is the god of lightning. He controls the lightning. You know? He's the reason a storm happens. If that sort of stuff is still true to these gods, and that's what makes a god a god. You know? So if we go back to the start and answer the two main questions. What makes these groups different? And are there similarities? And do they all change based on what we believe? So, yes. There are, the groups are different. And the only real similarity is what they represent. And that is an idea, a belief in how the world works, why something is the way it is. I don't really know how to say that well or with good words. So we're using these words. But I hope you understand following. Because I think that's it. It's hard to describe what multi-pantheon gods represent, because they do represent everything. If you've ever wondered why, they're the answer to that question. That's the best way of putting it, I think. And yet, and what they can represent, this, I do believe this can change, and you got this, just, you can see it just within the whole Greek versus Roman debate and how how the Roman gods are, do have these slight different personalities to the Greek gods, because the Roman civilization had some fundamentally different beliefs. And that influenced the gods, because that's how the Voidenverse works. And the only reason we actually consider these two groups the same is because of the stories and how we can see and how they are referenced throughout time. And we can see that the Iliad was taken from Greek and given to the Romans. I think it's the Iliad, and modified. Is the Iliad with this, whichever one has the Siege of Troy in it. I'm not a history buff. I'm a STEM nerd that likes working things out. And this universe fascinates me in enough ways. Anyway, you all know this. This is why you're here. but they take the story and they add to it to produce the creation of their civilization. And where the Romans come from and why. So the story moves over to the Romans. So we consider these groups one. And I was watching an overly sarcastic production the other day on Artemis and Apollo, and how that changed over time, and how the Romans took them and modified them to fit their beliefs. And this is basically, this how the stories are told is how they are understood and can change and reflect these manifestations, which again leans into why the Norse is a bit weird, because that's the only way we understand them now. We don't have the deep and what could be considered more correct belief systems about these gods. We just have the Christian observations of this. So we don't really know why the Norse are the way the Norse are. But that's fine, because that's all the evidence we have. That's all the stories we know now, which means that's all that they can ever be. Until we learn something new, and then they can go backwards and become more what they were if somehow randomly we find new texts on them or something. And to answer the second question is, do they all change based on what we believe? And yeah, so that answer is yes. We have limited data points. I said this in the other question. Answer this is part of the other question, because I rambled without actually reading what my next notes were. So like I said, we take the Norse, and this, again, going back to the Artemis and Apollo thing, them being the sun and the moon isn't a Greek thing, but their Greek versions of the gods have them, because that is now ingrained as part of our understanding of them as gods, is Apollo is a sun god, but that came from the Romans. So really, only Roman Apollo should be a sun god, or Artemis is a much better example, because Artemis did a full name change and a whole god-like, which the Romans really love to do, which is where Britannia comes from. Anyway, Artemis is now the moon goddess, whether you're talking about Artemis or Luna. I should write that down. Artemis, Roman form. Diana, sorry. Because Diana became the moon goddess. We also consider Artemis the moon goddess. Whether that's because of Rick, I don't know. But they are linked to the current state of the world, not the post, not what they once were, even in Greek form. And I think that's really the understanding of what a god is. And the only way you can really link them together is that they are the answer to why. The reason, like, Surtr and the giant and the ice giants in the Norse mythology, the reason they aren't gods is they don't answer the question why. They're just something for the gods. They're the antagonist to the Asgardians when they stop fighting themselves. Like, that's the reason for their existence, is really, as far as like I can confer or find out or understand. But that's fine, because that's my understanding, which means, unless someone can out there can like go, oh, here's the story and here's the evidence in these books. Yeah, you know what I'm saying. I feel, yes. I say you know what I'm saying. Usually at this point, people say they've lost me. Thank you for indulging this theory. If you have any comments on this theory or theories of your own that you want me to discuss, you can email them to boo.t.mist@gmail.com. or you can come over to the Instagrams, follow us there, and DM us at @who_myth. Make sure to follow the podcast, like this podcast, subscribe to the podcast, or whatever you do to help the podcast get out there. I've been Owen, and come back next time as we try to see through the myth. A challenge to the gods really, it speaks to me.